Good evening, freedom fighters, patriots throughout Saskatchewan, across the country, and around the world. For those of you around the world, there's only a few, but they are out there. How are we all doing tonight? Monkeypox is the trending phrase of the day. I got to show you this clip because it's hilarious. By Mark Stein. Some of you may have seen it, but I'm going to show you this clip to start the show off because it's a great way to start the show off. And we got to have some fun with this insanity, or we'll go insane right along with everybody else that's insane. Let's try that. There we go. All right. So here, check this out. This is good for a laugh. Okay. Yeah.
People seem to be sure there's still some folks wandering around in their masks, but even Jacinda Trudeau showing a lot of nose these days. Here he is arriving for an audience with the Prince Regent in Ottawa yesterday. Oh, look at that. Look.
So the douchebag spent his whole time in a war zone in the Ukraine without a mask on, and he comes back home and he meets with the prince douchebag and he's got a face diaper on. It's just, it's phenomenal. God, he has to be a full on sociopath. There's just no question in my mind that he is a full on sociopath, psychopath, whatever. To be able to do this and then still talk like anyone thinks he's genuine whatsoever. And people believe him. There are people in Canada that believe this idiot. It's phenomenal.
Oh, on the nose, very sexy. And is that just a hint of nostril? The COVID equivalent of what I believe the tabloids call a nip slip. Well, you and perhaps even princes and prime ministers may be moving on from the COVID, but fortunately, our rulers have the next big thing already lined up. Look at this, monkeypox cases spreading rapidly in Europe and North America. That's a man landing at an airport and getting tested for the monkeypox. Just a quick zap on the forehead. It's said to be especially prevalent if you're bisexual or if you're Canadian. And let's face it, who can tell the difference? Bill Gates, the big money bags behind the World Health Organization and its new pandemic treaty, has been warning about this new plague for some time. Let's take a look at Bill Gates. So, yeah, there he is. That's the first sign you've got the monkeypox, aside from being Canadian. The first sign is that you develop two huge pox on the front of your chest. Initially, they're very perky and rather fetching, and then within days, they drop 7 inches. Isn't that right, Bill? Fortunately, there's a vaccine. Monkeypox's spread boosts shares of vaccine manufacturers.
Yeah, right.
You don't say. Gee, it's almost like these days the only businesses worth being in are diversity consultancies, statue removal services, and pharmaceutical companies. But it's true. United States buys millions of monkeypox vaccines as Massachusetts man infected. Mamma mia!
God.
Here they go again. How long until monkeypox mandates? Jabber, 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 said the monkey to the chimp.
Jabber, dabber, 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 said the chimpy to the monkey. Jabber, dabber, 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 said the monkey to the chimp.
That's how it's going to go. Jabber, 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 jabber. It's like Rise of the Planet of the Apes, as His Royal Highness the Prince Regent himself has warned Klaus Schwab's World Economic Forum in...
No alternative, because otherwise, unless we take the action necessary and we build again in a greener and more sustainable and more inclusive way, then we will end up having more and more pandemics.
Yeah, more and more pandemics. He's got it, hasn't he? He's got the monkeypox. That's why he's monkeying with us. I'd rather take my chances. I'm Canadian, but not terribly bisexual, except on bank holiday weekends. But here's the problem. Let's assume that our presiding geniuses are correct and that their next big thing really is a thing. The problem is that all our COVID architecture remains in place. So we're just going to tackle it in the usual way. Lockdowns, collapsed economies, traumatization of our children, one size fits all vaccines, and the ruthless suppression of wide open, vigorous, honest discourse. Here's the groupthink narrative, boys and girls. And if you disagree, Andrew Neil and Twitter and the British Board of Film Censors and self-proclaimed fact checkers like Full Fact, fully funded by American bazillionaires to kill British free speech. All these people are going to come down on you like a ton of monkeypox bisexual Canadian bricks. We need the last 2 years fully repudiated, its grotesque laws and powers repealed to ensure it never happens again. No more of the big shut up, no matter how many monkeypoxes and pangolin poxes and aardvark poxes are unleashed upon us.
I gotta go back to Bill Gates for just a second.
Bill Gates, the big money bags behind the World Health Organization and its new pandemic treaty, has been warning about this new plague for some time. Let's take a look at Bill Gates. Oh, yeah, there he is. That's the first sign you've got the monkeypox, aside from being Canadian. The first sign is that you develop two huge pox on the front of your chest. Initially, they're very perky and rather fetching, and then within days, they drop 7 inches. Isn't that right, Bill? Fortunately, there's a vaccine. Monkeypox's...
And that's really the key to all of this? Is we have to make fun of them. We have to destroy them in the media. We have to do whatever we can to dismiss, ignore, and shame them out of existence. We have to. So I think Mark Stein's onto something. Hopefully more people get onto this and shame the hell out of these people because they're insane. Speaking of monkeypox, did you guys happen to see what's going on here?
Bread boost.
No. That's enough of you. All right, let's do this one instead. All right, so here it is, folks. This, you remember back, I guess it was probably November, December of 2019, when they had the old Event 21, Event 201. And that was a tabletop exercise by these assholes preparing for the next pandemic, COVID-19. And lo and behold, a short month or two later, we're finding ourselves all locked down and losing our freedoms, and having our economies destroyed, having our debt ballooned into oblivion, and among other things, suicide rates shot up, opioid crisis went through the roof, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, domestic abuse, all of these lovely byproducts of destroying the economy and destroying our way of life. So they planned for it, and then it just happened to materialize. Well, here we go again, folks. This is strengthening global systems to prevent and respond to high consequence biological threats. So the results from the 2021 tabletop exercise conducted in partnership with the Munich Security Conference. Right. So let's just scroll down here. I'm not going to get too into this. I just want to show you this one part in particular. So there we are. Let me just see if I can make this bigger and get my fat mug out of the way. Developed in consultation with technical and policy experts. There we go with the experts again. The exercise scenario portrayed a deadly global pandemic involving an unusual strain of monkeypox virus that first emerges in the fictional country of Brinia and eventually spreads globally. Later in the exercise, the scenario reveals that the initial outbreak was caused by a terrorist attack using pathogen engineered in a laboratory with inadequate biosafety and biosecurity provisions and weak oversight. The exercise scenario concludes with more than 3 billion cases and 270 million fatalities globally. As part of the scenario development process, NTI conducted a virtual consultation with experts in December 2020. Blah, 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 blah. So here you go, setting the table for yet another pandemic. I can only hope that this time around people get it, that there's less people sucked in by their narrative, sucked in by the fear that they're trying to create. I can only hope. Because we can't, obviously, we can't take another round of this. And it seems the COVID narrative fell apart on them. The vaccine narrative's falling apart on them. People are dying everywhere. People are starting to get it en masse. So it's falling apart. Even the Shanghai videos, even the North Korea narrative, hasn't worked. Not enough people are buying into it because people are tired of it. So what do? Then they bring in something else, monkeypox. Somebody said take out the K and you get moneypox, and essentially that's what all of this is, money and control. So there we are. I don't want to dwell on that a whole lot, but it needed some attention today. It was trending on Twitter, so I thought we'd talk about it a little bit. No, you're right. Not enough people have woken up, but you know, sooner or later, I guess they will. And it's ironic, of course. I did this in my 2-minute drill and mentioned this, that of course this is happening in conjunction with, in 2 days, the World Pandemic Treaty, along with the Davos crowd at the World Economic Forum are meeting, the World Health Organization, the World Health Assembly, they're all meeting. So hopefully, I really probably can't say that what I want to say, but you guys can probably assume what I was going to say, given that they're all together in one place. So the other thing that I have to talk about as well tonight, before I bring my good friend Salim Mansour in to join us, is I have to touch briefly on the speaking tour that is being planned in Saskatchewan that myself and Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson are going to be a part of. I did a 2-minute drill on this earlier today as well, but some of you may not have seen it, so I'll mention it again. It is sponsored, this tour is sort of sponsored by the True North Saskatchewan political entity. I can't refer to them as a party yet because they're not a party. They are hoping to become one. And one of the ways you become a party is to get enough signatures. And so they're going to be collecting signatures at these events that me and Laura Lynn are speaking at. So I would call it a partnership. It's not an endorsement. I'm not endorsing any of the ulterior or alternative political parties in Saskatchewan as of yet. And that's the Buffalo Party, which is a registered party. That's United Saskatchewan Party and the True North Saskatchewan Party. Those are the last two aren't parties yet. They're both hopefuls. So there's a process that's going to have to go on here in Saskatchewan, and the cream will rise to the top. And, you know, whoever comes out on top, hopefully the others will swallow ego and unify under one entity, one alternative to offer the people of Saskatchewan. So I'm not in, it's not an endorsement of the True North entity. I've also made the same offer to the Buffalo Party, and I made the same offer to the United Saskatchewan entity. You know, at any time that you're doing running events, if you want me to be there, I'll be there. I'm supporting all of these people in what they're attempting to do, and all of them are attempting to form a viable alternative to the reigning establishment Sask Party that has failed us miserably in Saskatchewan. So again, not an endorsement, it's just a partnership. And again, I'd offer that same partnership to the Buffalo Party or to United Saskatchewan entity, whatever they turn out to be. And for me, it's the same policy as always. If I'm offered a platform, I'm going to take it, because we need to educate and inform as many people as possible. And if an opportunity like this arises, I'm going to jump at it every time, because we have to get this message out. We have to educate the voter, and we have to stop this nonsense. So yeah, anyone who creates platform, I'm there. So it is what it is. But I knew that there was some confusion, and obviously there's confusion. You know, when my name is associated with a political entity, people are going to make that connection automatically, and I get it. I understand, but it's important that I clarify and make sure everyone's aware that it's not an endorsement. That'll come later when it's time, but I'll let this do what it needs to do. So anyway, so that's that first couple of things out of the way. Oh, I'm going to put the link to that report. Or that link that I showed, I'll put it in the chat, and you guys can share it out and have a look at it. So that's that. Now we'll go on with the rest of the evening with my good friend Salim. It is Friday night, and so tonight we're going to talk about foreign policy, Canadian foreign policy, which, you know, ultimately has nothing to do with Canada and nothing to do with the benefit of any Canadian. It's obviously all toward a globalist governance and an agenda. So anyways, without further ado, good friend Salim Mansour. Hello, Salim.
Hi, good evening, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, my friend?
I'm good too. I'm good. You're introducing tonight's discussion as foreign policy. Do we have one?
Yeah, right.
That's a discussion we need to have.
Yes, I believe it is. Well, and we're, yeah. And I mean, let's face it, we're the only two people in Canada that seem to want to talk about it. So, you know, it's up to us.
Yeah, I mean, on a very serious note, I mean, we have slips, and we are slip sliding into a situation of a war. We have become a belligerent country in a war in Ukraine. against Russia, which is a nuclear power, one of the five permanent members of the United Nations. And there is absolutely, as far as I know, any serious discussion, both within the government in Ottawa, in the parliament, where these matters should be debated and discussed, nor is there any serious engagement in the public square, you know, in the media and so on. And therefore, the question that, in a sense, begs all of us, are we a nation with a sense of when we get involved in foreign conflicts, which is, after all, the main issue in terms of war and peace, do we just follow the lead of others, or do we have a clearly defined position of what is a respectable, independent, sovereign state? And it seems to me that that's a question that begs itself right now, you know, with the dangers escalating in the Ukraine war. And, you know, to ask that question and then to explore it in a historical context.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, we're getting into these. I'm actually a little bit encouraged and maybe even excited is the right word, because it's so blatant and it's so out there. Even though the media isn't covering it, there's enough of us, there's enough of people on social media that are covering this destruction of our sovereignty, our freedoms, our way of life, because of this globalist agenda. I mean, we're seeing it, and especially, you know, when you talk about, you know, through the COVID experience, Klaus Schwab and COVID-19 and the Great Reset and Trudeau backing him up and telling the world. And so, you know, every little bit that we move forward, more and more people are sort of awakening to this. And even up till, as we talk about in these days, 2 days before the global pandemic treaty that's about to be signed, or at least changed, the constitution of the World Health Organization needs to be changed at the World Health Assembly. So it's the beginning of the process to then have the World Health Organization dictating to all nation states during a pandemic that can be, as we've seen, created at any whim. And so, you know, here we are. But as these things are happening, more and more people are being awakened to the reality that, you know, our government, our establishment parties do not have the best interest of Canadians at heart. They are not working on behalf of the people that elected them. They are working on behalf of some unelected foreign entity.
Yeah, I mean, whether they have the best interests or not, it's not only a moot question. It further leads on to that, on these very important issues, war and peace issue, now the pandemic health issue, what we've gone through the past 3 years, that these issues that cut to the bone of who we are as a sovereign state leads to the question that the decisions are made in which people are not consulted. Where would people be consulted? In the parliament. Who is the voice of the people? The various political parties and the members of the parliament that the people elect. But once people do their part, which is, you know, we are having an election here in Ontario, do their part, they go out and they vote. Once the voting has taken place, what then subsequently happens in the provincial and in the national legislatures is a total disconnect. Now that we will go into the past. I want to touch upon the past because I believe there is a continuum. But what we have seen over at least the last 3 years, which is fresh in our memory, is that whatever is the views of the people have no effect on the policy that is pushed down from the top by the political elite, by the ruling class. There's a complete disconnect. And that leads to the question, I mean, the question that you pose about foreign policy. I mean, the WHO on May 22nd is coming down that they want to become the central authority in determining through the United Nations and as a United Nations body, determining what is the health crisis and what would be and should be the response of the international community. It will be dictated by some sort of an international czar, an international Anthony Fauci, which is, by the way, the present director general of the World Health Organization, this Ethiopian leader, Tedros, who is out and out an open communist, an absolute, you know, determined Marxist. And he and his people will determine for 193 nation states in the world what should be the policy in terms of global affairs on that particular package, that is the health issue. So just imagine, you know, it is a one-size-fits-all what they dictate, that, you know, we as an advanced industrial, you know, G7 country, we will have no say in the matter, no more than, say, Sri Lanka or Zimbabwe or anyone else, you know. That discussion hasn't taken place in this country.
No, and this is it. And you raise a really good point in that, you know, once there's these politicians, especially these establishment politicians, they like to say, yes, this is, of course, this is a democracy. You all just voted and you raised your voice when you went and voted and you picked who you wanted. And then all of a sudden, at that moment, the accountability is gone, right? And all of a sudden, they do whatever they want and they continue to go back on the idea, well, you voted. That's democracy. So now you have to live with the decisions that we're going to make and the consequences of those decisions. But this is where it becomes extremely important for us as a people to stay active, to stay engaged, to stay and continue to pressure your government in droves of people. And that's the only way that democracy can work. There's so many people that are frustrated right now with democracy and frustrated right now. But at the same time, there's a lot of people that don't accept the responsibility that we've sat on our ass for 5 decades and haven't held our politicians accountable. That's our job. That's our responsibility. And we need to take that responsibility back.
Well, democracy is not simply going on the date of voting and doing your duty as a citizen to cast your ballot for the individual and for the party that the individual is standing for, and come home and the matter is over. No, democracy means that whoever has been elected from the constituency, each of the 338 electoral districts across Canada, we're talking about in national term, that they go to Ottawa, they speak on behalf of their constituents, they listen to what the constituents have said, they come back and discuss with the constituent, and so on. The debate of the people takes place in the parliament, where the people's voices are represented through their elected representative. Now, I haven't seen that happening anymore. The members that we elect, they have no impact, no effect. They don't engage in discussion. I haven't seen in my electoral district in the elected member, as long as I have been here in London, Ontario, come back from Parliament and have an open town square meeting on some of the most fundamental issues, you know, and say, you know, this is being tabled, this is the motion that is being tabled, this is the policy that is coming down, this is the bill that has been prepared by the PMO and so on. And we want to hear from you. We want to explain you. What are your questions about? None of that ever happens. Well, you know,
and it's funny you mention that, because Brian Peckford made that suggestion that we should be forcing our MPs, our representatives, in every single riding across the country, we should be forcing them to quarterly town halls. where they report what they're doing and they address issues of the day. Like, for example, the Global Pandemic Treaty. Where do you stand? Where does your party stand? What are you doing to stop this? What are you doing to oppose this? And but we need to do this, right? We need to hold these guys and these women accountable, and we need to force them to explain their decisions and explain what they're doing on our behalf.
Absolutely. I mean, in the campaign that I was involved in as a candidate as recently as 2019, you know, in my public campaigning, I made it a point. I said that, you know, if you elect me and if you send me to Ottawa, one thing I can assure you will happen, irrespective of whatever else happens, in which your elected representative has no, in a sense, influence directly. It is decided by the prime minister, by the leadership. But as your member of parliament, you can be sure that I will be calling for a quarterly town hall right here in London. And we will engage in discussing what are your concerns, what is happening in Ottawa, and what we can do about it. And I'll take that message to Ottawa, you know. That point I made, but here it is, you know. What we are talking about, what Brian Peckford is talking about, is something that is not waiting for anybody else to start it. It should be done by the individual member to start it off himself. The question is, why doesn't it happen? And that leads to the bigger question, whether it's foreign policy issue, economic policy issue. Tonight we want to talk about foreign policy. The last few weeks we have been talking about the war in Ukraine, which is not again in public discussion, but it is the burning issue around the world. We are seeing how dangerous the situation is becoming. People are talking about that, as people in authority are talking about the possibility of contemplating a nuclear exchange in terms of tactical weapons in the battlefield. And that's the spark. I mean, there's already a spark taking place, but that's the spark ignites, God forbid, that the NATO countries, which is basically being led by the United States, pushing a NATO to war with Russia, is already, you know, belligerent about it. And they see that they will have to maybe pour in more weapons, pour in even higher quality of weapons, both in terms of quantitative and qualitative nature, to prevent what is becoming more and more apparent, that Russia is going to roll over Ukraine. This is not something that is, you know, anybody false flag waving. It's simply the fact of the matter that the Russia will grind Ukraine down. It's already, there are news about the Ukrainian army, the present army, whatever it is made up of, is the point of collapse. And to prevent that collapse, if they escalate the war, we are in very dangerous grounds. And this is, I mean, apart from what you raised about the WHO, and it goes back to climate change, it goes back to all of the UN agenda, you know, 2030, Millennium Sustainable Goal, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, I mean, who is a conservative? The question, there's so many questions to be asked, but who is a conservative in that philosophical sense? A conservative is ultimately a person who fights for peace, who tries to prevent a war, not to engage in being a pyromaniac, starting a bigger fire instead of dousing the fire down, you know? Because the very word conservative means to conserve life.
Conserve, right.
And everything begins from there, you know, and that is the most fundamental question of all questions with which the United Nations was born after World War II, or during the last phase of World War II. It was the most fundamental question in World War I. It is the most fundamental question in just about everything, you know, when a people chooses to become engaged in a conflict. with another state. So here we are, 10 weeks after the shooting war started, the special military operation started by Russia going into Donbass region, we have Canada, officially we're not declared it, but we have a prime minister going to Kiev, a deputy prime minister going to Kiev, you know. I go into the global affairs website and I look at it and I'm trying to search and find what is the basis of our involvement in Ukraine, and there is no substantive answer. There's a whole list of how much money we are throwing into Ukraine, you know, already in this 8 weeks or 10 weeks. The figures are astronomical. Nobody has debated it. We are in excess of over or close to $2 billion that the Prime Minister has just thrown away in financing the Ukrainian government in this period. We are pledging to send in more arms, more equipment, soldiers, training up in Poland, you know. We are doing all of this under the rubric that Canada is a NATO country and that NATO is involved. But how is it NATO involved? Ukraine is not a NATO member country. You know, I mean, the whole discussion was about Ukraine becoming a member, and Russia, Putin, preempted that to stop from Ukraine becoming a member by putting in the application. It would then be a formality. And then NATO would be at the front porch of Moscow. That's the situation also now faced with Finland and Sweden. So technically, legally, in terms of international law or in the terms of organizational law of NATO, Ukraine is not a NATO country. So what is it? There is no Article 5 of NATO charter that has been invoked. Article 5 is what, if one NATO country is attacked by a non-NATO country, then immediately NATO will go into a collective discussion of taking collective measure together against the aggressive country. But that's not the case over here. There has been no such invocation of Article 5. And yet, we Canadians have simply walked into it. That is, our Prime Minister have taken our country into a belligerent position with Russia. And if this war escalates, we are then party to the war. You know, already on the question of sanction, we have taken measures as part of NATO to sanction to the maximum Russia. Russia has responded in sanctioning targeted issues in Canada. So it leads to, well, if this government is doing it unilaterally, where is the voices of others that are not members of the Liberal NDP caucus? This government technically now, with the deal that they have made, Justin Trudeau and Jagmeet Singh, is basically a coalition government. They don't call it a coalition government. It is a coalition government in which Justin Trudeau now basically has a majority and consequently will serve the full term going into 2024. And that's the deal that they have made. And NDP is not going to question it. NDP is no longer a party devoted to the cause of peace, just as it is no longer devoted to the cause of standing up for the working class people, which is what was its origin, you know. It has abandoned all pretension, you know. It is a party that is part of the globalist agenda and wants to impose the globalist agenda right down our throat, whether we agree with it or not. So NDP Liberal coalition government is in power in Ottawa. Well, then what about the opposition? We have something like 120 plus members of the Conservative Party, Nobody is raising a question. Everybody is displaying their virtue signaling sign and running around. The media is all over the place on the same matter. And so there has been no discussion of how have we come to this position. Just as there was no discussion of how we ended up with almost 3 years of lockdown, vaccine mandate, our fundamental rights suspended, which leads to the question, do we have any fundamental right? Do we have any constitution? Is it simply the whim of the ruling class? Right. We are now in that situation that we have come down to. And so we have to back up and ask the question, when and how, or was it always a situation this, that Canada has never had an independent foreign policy? Because, I mean, in effect, if Canada is not an independent sovereign state, then what is Canada? And that question leads to the following sort of answer, to ask ourselves, at least rhetorically, is Canada a vassal state?
Right.
We have a flag, you know, which is what Mr. Lester Pearson put together, you know, a maple leaf, a two red bands, and that became the flag. I mean, there was a lot of discussion about it. This was before my time. But, you know, how and why did we have to change the flag? Okay, so we became independent, you know, we after the centenary year, we wanted to demonstrate our, you know, a state of national sovereignty and so on and so forth. But the question remained, because on the fundamental issue, it's not about symbolism. It's right. Not about national anthem. Is it that do we people, through our elected representative, make decision that is our decision as a sovereign people? Or is the decision, the policies that are made in Ottawa, is cut according to, and let's use the word now, the oligarchs who rule this country, the Laurentian elite who rule this country, cut along their preferences in serving whichever is their master? That's the question that, as I look at this situation, historically, I'm asking myself.
Yes.
And so we can go back in time. We can go back in time to 1867 and before 1867. But before 1867, we was simply a colonial country ruled by our mother country, Great Britain. And that takes us all the way back to 1759 and the war that Britain won over the French, which brought the British North America together. And then after the 13 colonies separated, that is, you became United States of America, we carried on as the colony of the mother country, Britain. So as a colony, we have no basis of our independent foreign policy or independent anything. We just, like municipal government, running our local affairs under the flag of the mother country, you know? Because we have to be able to define what is our national interest. That is what an independent sovereign state's first obligation is, you know. In a world of nation states, what is our national security interest, our interest in the world?
But when we have a prime minister who refers to us 1 week after being elected the first time as the first post nation state without an identity, then we know what our government sees us as and what the path that they're going to take us on to ensure that it happens. And that, again, is the destruction of the nation state. Before we go any further, Salim, I want to show this graphic that you sent to me on email. And I was very struck by this. I was very surprised, as a matter of fact. I'm just going to blow it up full screen so everyone gets a good shot of it. It says, map showing the West and the rest of the world divided over the Ukraine war or the war in Ukraine. And in yellow are all the countries, so basically NATO, that are united the governments anyway, and look at the rest of the world in gray that are not. I find that shocking, actually.
Well, if you keep that map on yep. your screen, and let's talk a little bit about the map, because it is what has happened. And over the past several conversations that we have had on the war in Ukraine, one of the things that I've been pointing out that Ukraine has now brought into focus the war. But this is the unintended consequence. I don't think Moscow planned it. I don't think Washington planned it. The war was escalated and brought about by Washington and the policies in Washington that the Biden administration, driven by the neocons. And I think that deserves a conversation in itself. Who are the neocons? Who are pushing it? Because that goes back into the history of Ukraine, you know, and the warning. We have touched about that, you know, the Maidan coup and so on and so forth, you know, the expansion of NATO eastward after the end of the Cold War. And we have touched upon that, but we can go back and again look at it. But what happened is once the war started, that is, the special military operation started, things began to take on its own dimension, you know. And just as an aside, I would tell my students, you know, when your parents saw each other for the first time and looked into each other's eyes and decided that they would like to spend their lifetime together, they never calculated that you guys will be coming along the pipe, you know, and they will be spending sleepless nights and so on and so forth. In other words, the unintended consequences. Nobody plans this. It happened. The war happened. Once its shooting started, people started thinking about it. The world started thinking about it. The matter went into the UN on the war. And as I pointed out, this took on the shape of globalists versus the anti-globalists. That is, those pushing the globalist agenda, the WEF agenda, EU and NATO agenda, all together under the Biden administration, and the Biden administration, which is the Obama administration, Hillary Clinton administration. This is the globalist thing, you know, and the American empire. The middle break was the Trump administration, which was America first, which rejected all of this thing. And Biden administration came back, and you can see that immediately on coming back, they pushed the globalist agenda. Putin was acting in defense of Russian national security position, and he took action. He kept warning. His warning went all the way back to 2000 that nobody paid attention to, and they kept humiliating the Russian. And so finally, he took action, you know. So, but from the global perspective, this war has brought together all of the underlying problems in terms of globalism and the pushback against globalism. And I called it the Great Rupture. Now you look at the map and you can see the Great Rupture taking place. Yeah. The entire map, the gray area, which is comprises of over or close to 80% of the world population, yeah. Right? Take it from below United States, that is from Mexico down to Tierra del Fuego in South America. That's a whole continent. Take the whole African continent. Take the greater Middle East from Red Sea to the borders of India, Pakistan. Take the whole of Asia then. It's all basically standing in some way, openly or understated, in support of Russia.
Right.
They're standing in support of Russia because Russia, they can clearly see, is defending their national security interests, their nation state, against the dictates of America through NATO, of the liberal rule-based order. On the one side is these people talking about liberal rule-based order. On the other side, Russia, China, India, Pakistan, Brazil, all of Africa, all of Latin America are standing together for international law based upon the fundamental UN Charter, not UN Agenda 2030, not a Millennium Goal, not none of that. It is the fundamental charter. And it is the charter that was invoked by Putin, Article 51 of the UN Charter and the R2P to go into defense of the people in Donbass. Okay.
So the question,
go ahead.
I want to, this is an important part to this. Somebody in the chat, Christina, says, I have a very hard time understanding how all the world government leaders are okay to go along with the lunatics like Klaus Schwab and Gates and to kill billions of people, and how can they even think that this is okay? So in other words, why are all of our Western leaders, as the map shows, they're all World Economic Forum puppets, why are they doing this? And this is a question that I get asked all the time. And I'd like you to answer that this time, Salim. Why are they doing the
war in Ukraine, the proxy war in Ukraine, or
the bigger picture? Why are they committed to this World Economic Forum or UN agenda, Great Reset, whatever? It's all one and the same anyway. Why would our Western leaders want to go down that path?
Well, the Western leaders that are going down the path began quite a ways back. I mean, technically, that is at the end of the Cold War.
Right.
But the ideology of one world government is as old an ideology, which we have discussed way, way back. But let me quickly try to refresh in a capsule. Goes way, way back to whether it is Marxism, Karl Marx, Communist Manifesto, that the workers of the world unite, they don't have any nation, they don't have any borders, and so to bring it to the capitalist countries who have borders and so on and so forth. So that's the Marxist aspect to it, Marxist vision to it of a borderless world that is going to be socialist, that will be one government that will dictate. But there are other ideas also at play that has been at play. From a religious perspective, you know, the Roman Catholic Church is a global church, and it will run a global thing. And there was the Holy Roman Empire. There was this whole idea that there will be one sort of center that is going to determine. You know, in some sense, when Islam became empire, you know, the religion is not an empire, but the politics becomes an empire when Islam. So they develop the whole notion of a khalifa, you know, one central government that will rule over all the people of Islamic faith, of Muslim faith. And the last world government from the Muslim Islamic faith was the Ottoman Empire, you know. So these ideas have always been percolating. That you think about it, you know, going back way back into history, Pax Romana, the peace of Rome. Rome is the world empire, and it is ruling. At that time, the world empire was around the Mediterranean, you know. Mm-hmm. Alexander the Great going out to make an empire for himself. So, but in modern time, you know, the idea of world, one borderless world, have two different tracks. One is the Marxist ideology of a one world government led by the working class party. And parallel to that is the liberal idea, which was represented by Woodrow Wilson when he brought about and he pushed for the creation of the League of Nations. But he was stopped by the senators back at home who didn't give him the permission. But the whole idea was, and the war was the impetus. That is, to stop wars, you have to create one government, one world government, and impose the dictates of that government upon the rest of mankind, you know. Who will be, from the Marxist side, we know it will be the Communist Party, it will be the workers' representative, and so on and so forth. Leon Trotsky, who was defeated by Stalin, his entire career, his slogan was about world revolution, you know. And when, by the time Lenin died in 1924, he had fallen sick, he had had a stroke after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. The notion was there was an they agreed, the leadership agreed, the Bolshevik leadership agreed that the revolution in Russia was an anomaly. It went against the theory of Marx because Russia was the most backward country or empire in Europe. You know, it was a peasant economy. So this would be a holding operation. Because of circumstances, the revolution had happened in Russia, and the Tsar had been overthrown. But this would be a holding operation while the communists in the heartland of Europe, principally Germany and France, they will rise up. There was an effort to have the German Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, that failed. The Weimar Republic crushed it, but the holding operation was there for a world revolution, and that revolution would be led by the working class leadership in Europe and the advanced. That never happened. And it was with Stalin who defeated Trotsky and expelled all the Trotsky's followers, who, by the way, ended up in America. And that's a discussion, neocons, that we need to talk about at some future point in time. Stalin was not about world revolution because his entire slogan was socialism in one country, you know. And it is only as a result of Second World War that the Soviet army, that the Stalin's army, moved across into Germany, you know. But that would not have happened if there had been no Second World War. So what if of history? So that's on the Marxist side. On the capitalist side, is the demand for one world government. Okay, you can have nation states, you can have borders, but those are only charade. The fundamental reality of a world government would be the rules that would be created by the capitalist financiers and industrialists. Today we call them oligarchs, you know, the really big powerhouses. So the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, you know, the J.P. Morgans, you know, these people were the financiers, were the bankers, were the industrialist house.
And this is where we've seen this, and you've talked about this before, where we see this convergence of communism and fascism coming together. You know, these two entities, these two ideologies that have historically fought and are responsible for the death of millions, have now decided that it's probably a good idea, if we're going to have a global governance model, that we combine our ideologies instead of destroying each other. Let's rule the world together. And that's essentially what we've seen.
Well, exactly. So whether Stalin eventually won the internal debate among the Bolshevik communists, you know, he eventually won because he expelled every one of them. He killed them, he massacred them, he threw them out. It was Stalinist party that came to that held power from the 1930s till Stalin died in 1953, and Moscow was the capital of world communism in that sense, but they were not interested in, they defeated Trotsky's argument. They were not interested in going out and making revolutions and so on and so forth, even though people will point out that, yeah, they supported the Chinese. The Chinese Revolution happened in 1949. They backed the Chinese. They backed Kim Il-sung in Korea. They backed the various organizations and third world military dictatorships like Saddam Hussein or in Congo or in Africa, Angola, Namibia. But to explain all of that, and we're trying to do it in a very short period, you know, I mean, these are long, complex historical situation, is very simple. All of that happened within the context of a Cold War, because the capitalist world was engage in financing and destroying the socialist communist world that is Stalin, that is Russia, you know. And so they, every action has a reaction, and so that is what it was. And many of the third world countries, I come from India, you know, after 200 years of British rule, white man rule, and so on and so forth, when they became independent, they didn't want to take sides with, on the one side of the capitalist, industrialist, imperialist power, on the other side is the communist. They didn't want to take sides, so they created what is called the Third World Non-Aligned Movement, you know, and India was a leader among that, you know, and so many African countries, many Latin American countries, they joined that. So that was a very special situation of the Cold War years and the division that took place. But when the Cold War ended, that division should have been also ended, but the division did not end, because what happened is, as we look back upon it, ironically, the communist headquarters moved from Moscow to Brussels. Because what happened, and again, this is a long history, it began in the 1960s, 50s and 60s. The biggest communist parties, the most advanced communist parties in the world, was in Europe. The German party had been defeated, but there was the SPD, and the SPD is in government right now. The Socialist Party of Germany, you know, is right now in government, the chancellor. Then there were communist parties in France, in Italy, in Spain. These were not in, the communist party in Britain was not that big, but the biggest communist parties were in mainland Europe. And there was always the threat that these communist parties might come to power through open election, because they appeal to the workers. The second largest party in France after De Gaulle's party, when De Gaulle became the president, was the communist party. The second largest party in Italy was the communist party, and so in Spain. Well, what happened? The Cold War became hotter, heated up between Washington and Moscow with the issue of nuclear weapons, with the issue of missiles, intercontinental missiles, ballistic missiles, and so on and so forth. The communists in Western Europe, the communist leaders in Western Europe, they came together and said that, you know, we cannot win this argument. We have to become the leaders of the peace movement. And throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, the peace campaign in Europe was led by either directly the Communist Party or by movements that were infiltrated by the communists, you know, campaign against nuclear weapons, campaign for disarmament, so on and so forth. All of this is now forgotten. But the 1950s, 60s, 70s and 80s were the age of massive mobilization in Europe against both the Soviet Union and Washington, that is NATO. And these communist party leaders, one of the most important one was the Italian Communist Party leader. His name, I think, was Enrico Berlinguer, if I remember him correctly. And the Spanish leader, they came together and they called themselves Eurocommunists, and they moved away from Moscow. They moved away from Khrushchev, Brezhnev, Kosygin, and they said, we represent the interests of Europe, a democratic society, and we give up the question of, you know, violence and revolution. We move forward in terms of democratic process, Eurocommunism. But Eurocommunists gave up all of those ideas. That didn't mean that they had given up the fundamental idea of the state ruling from the top, the lives of the people. And so when the Cold War ended, my view is that when the Cold War ended, Eurocommunism became European Union, EU, and the headquarters of Europe, of EU, became Brussels. And when you watch and you examine the system by which EU is governed, it is a copy of the Soviet model. EU is run by commissioners. There are 12 commissioners. They are non-elected, so they are appointed members. You know, who appoints them? Well, the powerhouse and the financiers and the backroom boys appoint them. So that's where the power is. They're the non. Now the present EU leader is a woman, a Dutch woman, Ursula von der Leyen. You know, so she's the one who is dictating, but she has not been elected even as a cow catcher or dog catcher. But she is the. She is the commissioner. She's the head woman. Then you have a European Parliament. And the European Parliament is simply a talking shop. It doesn't make policies. The policies are made by the European Commission in Brussels. So you have the headquarters in Brussels of the Commission. You have the Parliament in Strasbourg in France, Belgium, France. In Brussels, you have the headquarters of the NATO. So the actual power center is Brussels. The Europe does not have a military muscle. So the military muscle is provided by NATO. And that is located in Brussels. And that's where the Commission headquarters is. So that's what has happened. Okay. But coming back to Canada. We are a NATO member. We can go back when we joined. We joined NATO in 1949 when NATO was formed, just after the Second World War. Then subsequently, some 9 years later, in 1958, NORAD was formed, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, and that is only Canada and the United States. Involved, but we are a member of NATO, and in this Ukraine situation, it has become a NATO war that has been pushed by the Americans. They are the ones who are pushing this, and the EU members of the NATO, that is Germany, France, Britain, Italy, and so on, so forth, they are going along with the right, particularly the Anglo-American relationship. It is the British and the Americans who are driving this. In terms of the war in Ukraine, and others are basically going along with it because they have very little say in military affairs. But in the case of Canada, as you see in the map that you put up there, there are those fundamental questions to be asked. What is our national interest? Is our national interest to go to war whenever NATO says that we go to war, whether it is in Serbia, now it is in Ukraine, whether it is color revolution, and now they're even talking about, the British Foreign Minister Liz Truss has talked about, that NATO should now be expanded all the way into the Pacific region to engage with and contain China. So are we now, you know, simply the vassal state of NATO? Or do we have an independent decision-making capacity? Right. And can we exercise those independent decision-making capacities? And so my point is, if you go back historically and look at it, you know, it comes to me, maybe others will have different points of view, and there should be a debate. But from my point of view, it goes back to right to our foundation, 1867, till the modern period, into the 20th century, Canada was under the umbrella of Britain. So we were, in that sense, a vassal state of Britain. We went to war whenever the British Parliament told us to go to war, or whenever the British Parliament declared a war, and went to war. So you can look at it. We went to war, for instance, in South Africa, the Boer War of 1899-1902. Ask the question, what was our interest? People from your part of the world, the prairies, or in Heartland, Ontario. By the way, the Quebec would not go, but English Canada always was up and ready to go, march, whenever London said to march. Right. So we went to war in South Africa. against the Boers, the Afrikaners who were fighting for their own independence, you know, and eventually they established the South African Republic. Then we went to war in when the war broke out in August of 1914. We were right there, you know, we went in, the country was split. That is the beginning of the whole debate of the conscription crisis, you know. The Quebec would not be participating in the war. Quebec would not volunteer to go to war. So it was English Canada that went to war, and English Canada that paid the price, you know, at Waimea Ridge and so on and so forth, you know. And we all look back at that period with pride that, you know, we as a nation state was born, you know, in blood and soil. We fought the war for the motherland, you know. Same thing happened in the Second World War, right off the gate, you know. We were in the war. The moment Britain declared war on September the 3rd, 1939, Canada was right into it, you know, Mackenzie King. Again, there was a conscription crisis. Again, the fact that French Canadian did not go to war. I mean, we don't want to discuss these matters because these are so delicate issues. Here was it, you know, the French Canadian, they take their pride, they're French, you know, their association is with France. Well, France was thick in the war in the World War One against Germany. Then again, in Second World War, France was eventually defeated. Paris was occupied, but Pierre Elliott Trudeau was riding his motorbike. He was not volunteering to go to fight, whereas, you know, English Canada went to fight, you know. And so again, a decision was made for us. Technically, it was our parliament making decision. But the question is, would our parliament have made a different decision? Would our parliament have said, you know, we have to think about it. What is our interest in it? We're going to invest in it. But that's in the case of India. India had no choice. India was not a dominion. India had no independence. Right. So Indians went to war as part of the empire. But Canada, technically, by Second World War, 1939, technically, after the Statute of Westminster, we had become independent, though we did not patriate our constitution. So our parliament was not in that sense independent. But Britain had handed us, said, you know, you can take your constitution. We had our own problems, so we didn't take it. But when the war came, our leaders just walked on. So again, I'm putting the dots, you know, we were behaving like a vassal state. Second World War ended in 1945. 5 years later, there was a crisis, the Korean crisis. The North Korean communists wanted to sweep across the peninsula and unite the Korean peninsula. The Americans decided to oppose that. Chinese Revolution had taken place in 1949. That was an impetus in some sense to the North Korean communists. At that time, there was no North Korea, so the communists in Korea to make a move to unite their country. And the Americans opposed it. And in their opposition, the Americans were able to bring together a coalition. You know, in 1950, the world was still very much, you know, being ruled by colonial powers. The only few countries that had become independent was India had become independent, Pakistan had become independent. There were not too many African countries that were independent. Latin America, same situation. So the Americans were able to control it and pass a motion in the United Nations called Uniting for Peace Motion, you know, which could not be vetoed in the Security Council by the Soviet Union. And therefore, in this Uniting for Peace movement, again, the Anglosphere stepped forward. Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand stepped forward. These are the countries that went to war in Korea and fought the war against the communists. That war ended, ceasefire was drawn, Canada came back. But the question is that we responded as an ally or a dependency of America and Britain. But at that time, in 1950, the leadership in Canada was still very loyal to Britain, because when Diefenbaker became the prime minister, Diefenbaker was totally a British man, you know. that the world was rapidly changing was not very much in his radar, in his horizon. So nevertheless, it is America and Britain that went to war under the Uniting for Peace motion in Korea, and we were right there. NATO was formed in 1949 to deal with the situation in Europe, divided Europe with the Soviet army and the Warsaw Pact army right in the middle of Europe. And so that was created in 1949. We joined. But the more interesting thing is, and this comes to the issue of Ukraine, is we, Canada and United States, came together to create NORAD, North American Aerospace Defense. Yeah. The question to be asked, why was it done in 1958? And the answer is very quick. We had entered the nuclear age. Mm. In 1945, the Americans were the ones who had the bomb. They dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to let the world know about it. And immediately the race began. In 1949, the Soviet Union got the bombs. They acquired the bomb. It escalated the tension. In 1958, the Soviet launched the Sputnik into space orbit, and the age of missiles came into being. And with that happening, Canada became a buffer state.
Yes.
Because our three oceans that had protected us, as it had protected America from the old world, now suddenly the third ocean, that is the Arctic, was stood between us and the Soviet Union and America. And in the age of nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles, we became a buffer state. And that crisis of a buffer state erupted under Diefenbaker's government.
Right.
And that came about with the Bismarck missile crisis, when President Kennedy got elected in 1960, came to office in 1961. He was faced with what became eventually the Cuban Missile Crisis, with Soviets trying to position their nuclear weapons in Cuba.
Right.
Now, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the question became of deploying defensive and offensive missiles in the borders of Canada and the United States, or in Canada. And Diefenbaker government went along and bought Bismarck missiles by scrapping Avro airplane, the fighter jet, which was supposed to be one of the most advanced fighter jet built at right. that time. But right. there was no buyer for it. Americans wouldn't buy it. And Diefenbaker government was forced, or at least that's what they claimed, they were forced to scrap that project because they couldn't sell that plane and end the bleeding, the hemorrhaging of the money that was being spent. And so in turn, they scrapped the Avro and they bought the Bismarck missile. Mm. The question became, the Bismarck missile, whether it would be a conventional warhead or a nuclear warhead. And after the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy asked the Diefenbaker government, or pressured the Diefenbaker government, to place nuclear warhead, American nuclear warhead, on the Bismarck missile. And the Diefenbaker government split. The foreign minister, if I remember his name, Howard Green, the foreign minister Howard Green, he opposed because it became a question of sovereignty. If it is American nuclear warhead, who's going to control the warhead? Who is going to make the decision? You know, and so on and so forth. We had come so close to a nuclear war in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So these became a massive internal debate, and the foreign minister was opposed to it, Howard Green. The defense minister, Douglas Harkness, if I remember the name, or Harkness. Anyhow, the defense minister was all in favor of putting into place the American warhead, because in NATO, Canadian soldiers and Canadian equipment were being deployed in Europe in a battleground situation where conventional and nuclear weapons were both available in the joint exercises with American forces. And so the government split on this decision. Yeah, and the election happened in April of 1963, or the government was already, this was the second term, Diefenbaker government was already losing support massively. This issue exploded. The Liberals under Lester Pearson kept quiet. They basically didn't make noise, in effect indicating to the Americans that if they form the government, they will go along with the American position. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. And the government fell. Lester Pearson came into office in 1963. And from 63 on, it's been a Liberal government with that minor break in 1979 when Joe Clark became prime minister for 9 months. Right. Then he was gone and so on. So we have a situation, as I look back, as people want to look back and connect the dot, that we move from within the umbrella of the Britain, where when Britain said, do this, we did that, in the question of war and peace, to the situation under America, you know, and beginning with the missile crisis, and the fact, the reality, which nobody wants to discuss, that Canada is a buffer state between two nuclear powers, you know, because when if intercontinental ballistic missiles start flying, it will be flying on over Canada. And if those weapons land, they will land in Canada. So we are the buffer state. And America will not allow any other power, in effect Russia, in that time Soviet Union, to say that we are going to encroach upon Canadian territory.
Right.
You cannot encroach upon Canadian territory, which would mean you're encroaching upon American land, American sovereignty. That goes back to the Monroe Doctrine all the way.
Right.
So we forgot that issue in this current debate, that there is a genuine national security issue in war with Ukraine. And
absolutely,
now with Finland and Sweden coming into question, that we have to be concerned about, take into account what is Moscow's position. We cannot be unilateral about this, you know? So that's exactly where we have arrived. Furthermore, in the question of war and peace, there's only one exception in modern times, where Canada did not participate under the orders of America in a war, that is after the end of the Cold War, did not participate, and that is to do with Iraq. Because Jean Chrétien said that the Iraq war does not have the UN authorization, and he was correct.
Right.
And so he refused, whereas Canada participated in Afghanistan. We immediately sent forces to Afghanistan. We fought there, you know, our brother Sean Taylor did his tour of duty in Afghanistan, and so many others. Fortunately, some of the people that we know, like Sean, they came back safe and sound. Others had their own casualties, especially with the J2F forces. But yeah, we were operating under UN authorization,
right,
that was moved in the Security Council. And in terms of, again, international law, and UN Charter provides the fundamental basis in modern time that all countries have signed onto, you know, on the issue of war and peace, and R2P. So as I step back, I mean, I've given a capsule version of the history, step back and ask, what is our national security interest in a global sense? Do we have one? What is it? Or is it our national security interest simply to follow the advice and to follow the orders of the master that we serve, under whose umbrella that we have positioned ourselves in? And that when that is exposed on the issue of war and peace, which is the most fundamental issue, and now the health pandemic, all the others then become clarified. Our elite will not ask our people, the Canadian people, their voice doesn't matter. It is simply what will be dictated and what will be done. So we have been taken down the slippery slope in the Ukraine issue to where we have arrived. And God forbid it doesn't go any further. But if it does go further, if the war becomes uglier, we are going to be deeper and deeper involved, in which there is no discussion and no seeking the view of the people of Canada.
Right, 100%. Absolutely, and you tied it up nicely. And that's, you know, I mean, that's the reality of it all. And we got a big mountain to climb to change this. But again, the only way it's going to change is by us doing more of what we're doing. And again, we're the only two that talk about this thing. And Salim, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your wisdom and your knowledge. And
I don't know whether it is wisdom, but it's simply asking historical questions.
Yeah, well, it is. And your ability to remember all of these things that you've learned is really phenomenal. I'm always amazed. So thank you so much again for spending another hour and a half with us and giving us your perspective. We'll continue this series on next Friday.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But as you can see, the more we dig deeper into it, and so we are waiting to go into the constitutional issue, the thing is that this is simply a mask. We are not actually, in effect, a sovereign, independent country. We have believed that we are, and the people are now openly smoking cannabis because now the government has made it legal, and they want you to smoke more cannabis. So we are blowing smoke. We believe in something, but there is no substance to it.
All right, 100%.
Okay, we'll be back whenever you want me to be back. If next Friday, I'll be there with you.
Next Friday, 100%, absolutely. And I'll be giving you a call probably in the next few days, and we'll talk about what we're going to talk about again.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, my friend. Yeah.
Okay. Good night.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, another round with Salim. And no, who said that? Who said that? Somebody said something there. And it's not even close to true. Somebody said that I was falling. Oh, yeah, they're freezing. You look like you're about to fall asleep and really not interested in what he's... Of course I'm interested. I listened very intently the whole time. Because it's very interesting. I love history. So your perception's a little off. What else do we got here? 1931-82. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks again for educating us. Wish Salim was going to be with you on your Sask tour. Yeah, he's not even going to be with us on our Northern Ontario tour, because he didn't realize that his daughter, he's already been to the prom for his daughter, but his daughter actually formally graduates on the 27th of June and is then having a party on the 28th of June. So we're trying to figure out how to get him to start the tour with us up to Thunder Bay or Marathon, and then how we're going to get them from there to London, to be in London for the 27th and 28th, and then how to get them back. I guess by that time it'll be Sudbury to then continue on with us to North Bay and then of course to Ottawa. So we're trying to figure out how to do this. I don't know how it's going to work out. But he may not be able to join us because of that. So that's unfortunate, but it is what it is. I then asked him if he wanted to join us on the Saskatchewan tour, and we're still working out options. So we'll see where we land. But Yeah, I thought of Ed, actually. We'll have to figure out how much that'll cost and if Ed's willing and available, because it's no small flight from Thunder Bay to London. So, but yeah, that is definitely something we can consider. So we'll have a look at it. Yes, it would be great to have him in Saskatchewan. We'll see. There's lots of things that we have to talk about before we land somewhere. So we'll figure it out. Yeah, other than that, I think that's it. Hopefully I can go live a little more often in the next week or so. Things are really starting to get busy between my business and speaking engagements and politics in Saskatchewan and politics in the country and tours here and tours there. It's starting to really fill up. So, yeah. And of course, I'm still not fully recovered, but I'm doing precisely the amount that I feel comfortable with. So we'll see. Yes, Michelle, I know I'm missing the game. I'm going to go and park my ass in front of the TV and watch the rest of it now. So what's the score, by the way? Anybody know? Absolutely, Kelly Dearborn, spreading the message no matter what, under every and all circumstances. I'll never stop. Can somebody give me an update on the game? Anyone? 2-1 Calgary. All right, cool. Yeah, I won't, Patricia. It is what it is. The main thing for me right now is I get enough sleep. I can do anything if I get enough sleep. And still, to this day, I require about 12 hours of sleep. It's wild. And some days I feel guilty, but it just is what it is. Obviously, I'm still healing. And that healing process is tiring. So I obviously need sleep. And so I just ensure that I get it. And if I get it, then I'm good to go. Everything above that is good. So it's all good. Yeah, you betcha. All right. So anyways, that's that. That's a wrap. If you just joined us late, make sure you go back to the beginning of the video and listen to my little bit of an intro. There's some good information there. And yeah, me too, Aaron. Me too. It's been a long recovery, but it's a very solid recovery, I think. So yeah, it's all good. Anyways, that's that. That's a wrap. Remember, globalism bad, nationalism good. All right. Ciao for now.
See the truth, God, we need you now.